So for today, we are reading. We're in the middle of this chapter. Let's see. I guess we actually are reading the second half of the chapter, pretty much, the one that's called "Thought Forms in Space," and it's a wonderful reading, it seems to me. Of course, one of the things that I always notice with the TSK books is that whatever you're reading, whatever section you're reading, seems like it's just so rich and full of insight. And then you read the next, then you go on and read the next one, and that seems rich and full of insight. And it seems like it's really pointing to the very central issues. And I think that that just shows that TSK is rich and full of insight, I suppose. And also that it's a if you wanted to put it in a negative sense, you could say, and Rinpoche makes this point. I don't really mean that it's negative. TSK is a vision of reality, and we in fact are always enacting a vision of reality. It's not, we our ordinary world, and this is very much what the reading is about. Our ordinary world is constructed, and its claims to substance are constructed. And anything that we any description we give, or theory or view or vision, is constructed in the same way. And the time-space knowledge vision is also a construct in that way. It's, you could say, it's a field communique, which is a term that comes up in the reading today. The difference, there are two differences. One is that TSK is very focused, it seems to me, on not making claims about substance, not making claims about reality. Nonetheless, as Rinpoche writes, if you make a claim that reality is not real, that's also making a claim. It's also constructing a certain kind of reality. And so TSK is subject to that difficulty, that kind of tension. I don't think that's a problem, but it's good to keep in mind. The other thing that makes the vision of TSK different from the vision of our ordinary reality is something I've already mentioned, and that is that it's just so rich and filled with insight. The thing about our ordinary reality is that it takes a long time to set it in place. I'm not sure this is the best way to describe things, but it's a way that it is, we're generally, we are used to. We start off as babies, and we really don't have a much of a vision of reality. I think it's probably fair to say that any sentient being has a certain take on what's real, and in that sense is involved in thought structures. But at least babies are. But as we grow older, the whole point of raising a child, of educating a child, of is leading them into a particular version or vision of reality. And in that sense, you say, well, that's on the same plane as the TSK vision, but except for what I said before about TSK not making any claims. But the thing about our ordinary version of reality is that once it's in place, and that takes, let's say, the first 15 or 20 years of life to get most of the pieces together, it just kind of keeps doing the same thing. It's like this machine that you build, and it takes a long time to build it, but once you build it, it just keeps turning out the same product. So it's like building a factory. Maybe that's a better image. Once you build this factory, it just keeps on turning out the same product over and over and over and over again. And it's not very inspiring, It's like, let's imagine that this factory produces food, and so it nourishes you, it keeps you alive, but all it produces is beans. And so you spend your whole life eating beans, you don't even realize you have another option, so maybe that's okay. But in fact, there's the whole world of food out there. And so at a certain level, you can say one of the things that TSK is doing is introducing the possibility of moving away from our ordinary version of reality. To do that, it offers a different version, which is a vision, but the difference goes beyond that, in that in the end, TSK wants to penetrate our dependence on visions. So that was just a little background thought that occurred to me as I was preparing for class this morning, and I wanted to share it with you. So let's talk about unless somebody has a comment about that. Let's go into the reading a bit. So the fundamental idea in this section of the chapter, this concluding part of the chapter, is one that we've already been working with, and that is that thoughts communicate the substantiality of their content, right? That's the second sentence of the reading on page 53. Together with their content, they communicate the substantiality of that content. And we'll go on and look at the rest of that sentence in a little bit. How do they actually do that? But for now, the fundamental and interesting point is that every thought insists that what it's communicating is the way things are. Now, you might object, and it might not be true for every thought. I think it's true for the thoughts that matter the most. But last week we talked a little about the hypnagogic state when you're falling asleep and all these images, which are a kind of thought, pass through the mind. And they probably don't claim to be real. Because we're not committed to them. We see them as this stream of thoughts that's passing through the mind. And that actually is like meditation, right? In meditation, it's often said that you don't necessarily or you don't really want to cut off the process of thinking, but you also don't want to commit to it. You don't want to commit to the claims that thinking makes. You just see a thought passing. So there are ways in which you can disconnect from this claim of thoughts to be real. But most thoughts, the ones that shape our life, the reason they can do that is because they claim to be real. Because in addition to the content, they claim that the content is real. So if I see a tree, and I identify it as a tree, and we'll look in a little bit if we have time. We'll look a little later at whether there has to be that identification that goes along with it, or can it just be kind of a pure experience of treeness with no identification? But ordinarily we look at a tree and this label comes up that it's a tree if we're paying attention to it at all. We may not even notice that it's there, and the label is more than a label. The label is also a claim that what we're seeing is the real, is the tree, right? So we don't say that to ourselves. We don't say, we see a tree, and we don't even say to ourselves, I'm seeing a tree. That would be the thought, right? But the notion that labels are giving us our understanding of the world are really pronouncing a world, as Rinpoche says, that notion suggests that there's always this labeling process going on. So we see the tree, and there's a kind of implicit label that says it's a tree. And we don't usually notice that. We also don't notice the second part, and that's this substantiality issue. which is that every time we see something or experience something, there's this claim being made, this is the way things are. This is the way things are. This is the way things are. From moment to moment, we're affirming the substance of what it is that we experience, and we experience it through thoughts. And I suppose that a good place to look at that would be in movies, because in, or novels, but let's stick with movies. Because the thing about watching a movie is that we enter a kind of a halfway place. On one level, if we get involved in the story of the movie, we are going along with a claim that this is the way things are. On the other level, on another level, we realize that it's just a movie, and there's the movie screen in front of us, or nowadays more likely perhaps the television screen or the computer screen. And then there's all sorts of other things going on in our lives. So the movie just occupies one little part, and in that sense, we don't think of it as being real. But, the literary term for this is in order to get involved in a movie or a novel or whatever, there has to be a suspension of disbelief. So you see this image on the screen, and you have to suspend your initial understanding, which is just that it's an image on a screen, and accept it as being real. So the movie is also making a claim to being real, and to get involved with it, we partly accept that claim. So that's just a useful example, because the idea is that that's what we're doing all the time. We're constantly accepting the claim that the world that we inhabit, that we look around at, the trees and the cars and the sidewalk and the computers and the software program that's letting us interact, and you're seeing me on the screen and all of that, we are accepting the claim that that's the way things are. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's good to be aware that that's going on. So I think there's an important point to make about that, which is not obviously made in this reading, and that is, you can use the example of seeing a tree, but you can also use the example of feeling emotional, having an emotional reaction to a situation. So if you say, I'm feeling frustrated, right? That thought, that label is there, but there's also the claim that that in fact is the way I feel, right? That's the way things really are. And again, in meditation, you learn to question that. The emotion comes along, and you notice it as an emotion, but you don't necessarily identify with it or identify it as yours. But the ordinary way that we engage experience is we do identify it. We do say, this is the way I'm feeling. So I see Michael's having a problem. I'm sorry, Michael. Don't know what's going on, but he says he'll listen to the recording later. Okay. So we have these two different realms. And it's very helpful to be aware of the fact that this substance claim is going on in the realm of emotions, because one of the points that TSK is making is that you don't have to accept that claim to substance. And that's exactly, it's not only one of the points, it's the one that we're focusing on right now and have been focused on really in this course and the previous course. Is that, we populate a world, or we create a world which has its own space, but that space is already filled up with whatever we identify, and it's completely filled up. There's no gaps. There's a space that's disappeared. This is what we've been looking at. And the same thing is true for the thought realm. Whatever we label is already tied into a whole complex of labels, to a whole world, to a presupposed order is the term that Rinpoche used in what we read last week. Everything falls in place. There are no gaps. So TSK says, you know, that's just a construct. And it's very helpful to be able to look at that in terms of our reactions, the emotions we have, the judgments we make, the world we live in, which is just constantly being interpreted by us as having certain values and concerns, and then the identity. But you know, ordinarily we don't care so much. We don't think about. We see a tree and we don't say, "Oh, that's a label," and you know, I wish I didn't have to accept the truth of that label. There's a point where that may become relevant, but mostly when we, you know, our concern is, I'm feeling depressed or I'm feeling angry, and we say, gee, wouldn't it be good if I could see that label just as a label without accepting the substantiality? So that's, it's very good to look at that level. The second level is also there, and that's good to see also, because we want to understand as much as we can about the labeling process. So Karin has a comment here. When I notice a moment how I set up my reality, there's also a strong awareness of being alive and that this can change the next moment. There's a feeling of freedom and appreciation and also responsivity. Yeah, that's very good. I, you know, from other comments you've been making over the last couple of weeks, Karin, I know this is something that you're working with and appreciating, and it's great. You know, that is really what the TSK vision can offer. So that goes to a deeper level than what I was saying before. I was just saying that if we can understand that, let's say, an emotional reaction I'm having is really something that is just a label, is just a thought, and doesn't have substance, then it, you know, it dissipates, it disappears all by itself. The point that Karin is making is, it seems to me, and I hope I'm not misinterpreting you, is that it's not only that you see through the claim to substance, but you recognize the tremendous creative power of the naming process, the labeling process. And it really makes your experience much more alive, as Karin says, you know, that everything can change in the next moment. There's a feeling of freedom and appreciation. Yeah, I think that's very nice and very true. So there's both those levels, and certainly there's more that could be said too. Okay. We're still on the first paragraph of the reading. And actually, that second sentence, I want to go and I want to take a look now at the what Rinpoche writes about how thoughts communicate substantiality, or actually, that's not quite right. What is it about what thoughts communicate that make us accept their content as substantial? So he says, together with their content, they communicate the substantiality of that content. And then he says what that means. That's what I want to look at for a moment. A sense of persistent qualities and independent presence, a special kind of mass that exerts its own gravitational pull. And then he goes on in the next sentence to say that that's what structures things into a whole and confirms the established order. So there's persistent qualities, there's independent presence, and there's a kind of mass and gravity, and that's how we know that something is real. And you could say, we've been using the examples of, let's see, meditation and movies and the kinds of thoughts that float through your mind just before you're going to sleep or just as you're waking up. In those cases, those qualities aren't there, at least in the same way, right? It doesn't seem persistent. You know, let's say with the thoughts you have as you're falling asleep, they just kind of play themselves out. It's like watching a whole lot of different images floating across, again, a screen. And there also isn't a sense that there's substance to them. Well, it's kind of begging the question, but independent presence. And they don't really have the same gravity. They feel very light, but ordinarily what we experience doesn't feel light. It has the special heaviness, you could say, of being real. So kind of helpful to think here. Rinpoche uses the image of gravity, says thoughts have their own gravitational pull, or they communicate a special kind of mass that has its own pull. So, the modern understanding of gravity is something like being a curvature in space, right? So it's not some mysterious force that emanates out from an object, but the object actually curves for a space in a certain way. And the image that's used to describe that is like a big rubber sheet. If you throw a ball into that rubber sheet, the sheet deforms. It changes its shape, and that change in shape, that is gravity. Well, thoughts are kind of like that too, where the substances or objects that we recognize, they exert a gravitational pull, or in this image, they distort in a particular and characteristic way, or they give form in a particular and characteristic way to the space of the world that we inhabit. And that's what makes them fit into that world. And the world conforms to that. So that's the reality that we find ourselves inhabiting. It's quite a beautiful thing to think about how this gets created. That's related to what Karen wrote. But it means that we find ourselves in a world in which everything does have substance. The order has been established in advance. And there really isn't any possibility for freedom. So we want to examine how that works. But I think I'm going to go just a little bit out of order here in terms of what I had in mind to do. I think it'd be good for us to do a practice where we investigate this nature of thinking. And specifically, let's take a couple of minutes to really challenge the substance claim that thought makes. So we want to look at our experience, and just see how thoughts come and go. So there's kind of two levels to this. One is that thoughts, if you just let the mind, the idea here is just to let the mind completely go. Not try to do anything at all, and just see how thoughts come up and arise. And it doesn't have to be necessarily a thought about something, the past or the future. It might just be an image or any sort of thing. But we want to kind of tune in to this momentary quality, like the quality that you see sometimes when you're falling asleep. Things just drift through the mind so quickly. That's what we'd like to look at now. This leaves the question, what about the underlying sense of the way things are? Here I am, here we are meeting in a group across many thousands of miles, but here's this reality, and you have whatever computer or phone or whatever it is that you're using to connect up with us. What about that reality? Does that change from moment to moment in the same way? Well, that's a second question, and maybe as we do this practice, you'll have some insight into that. But the first level of the practice is just to let thoughts arise and try to tune in to this bubbling up quality. Rinpoche says that everything just kind of flashes into the mind. This is on page 53. So look at that flashing. Look at that bubbling up. So let's do that for a couple of minutes, okay? Okay, so the question, that it would be good for people to comment on is what you noticed. Is that in fact an accurate description that that thoughts come up in this way, in this kind of bubbling, flashing way, and that there's a kind of momentum to them? And then the second question I asked about, what about the underlying structure? I'm going to say a couple of things about that while we see if people would like to comment. Some people, well, would anybody like to say anything about that? Somebody's giving us a musical response. Okay, let's take a look at what David said. He says, looking out in the field at birds flitting atop the goldenrod, they lead. Let's see. I'm guessing here, the lively and lush green colors of the leaves overhead, it makes me feel good. Okay, so this kind of awareness of the flowing quality of experience may well lead to a appreciation of experience. It may lead to a kind of aesthetic appreciation of experience, and I think that's what that's one way to characterize what David writes here. I'm going to make one observation, which is that sometimes a thought leads you into a particular realm, and then there's a whole cascade of thoughts that come along with that. So if at one point I thought about something I'm dealing with, sort of an issue or problem I'm dealing with right now, and for a moment I was in that world, and all around, or as part of that world, there were all these other thoughts that weren't really voiced, but they were a part of the whole structure of what I entered into in that moment. So I don't know if that conforms to other people's experience, or if you had any similar kinds of experience. Karen says, gravitational pull is somehow related to an emotional tonus. Yeah, that's interesting. We've had this discussion various times. The world that we inhabit is not the physical world, which would surprise a lot of scientists and surprise a lot of people who make that claim. I'm starting to get a little feedback here, so maybe somebody needs to look at their, it's gone. Okay. That would surprise people, but the point is a fairly straightforward one. It's that we inhabit a world that is meaningful. It's not the world that scientists explore in the laboratory, let's say, or through a telescope. And part of that meaning is a kind of emotional flavor or pull or field, Karin says, tonus. And that does have to do with the world that a thought sets up. It sets up a world that not only identifies this object and that object, but has a certain feel to it, a certain flavor to it, a certain direction to it, certain projects that we're working on, certain ways of making sense out of our experience, sort of situating ourselves in our own past history. All of that goes along. All of that goes along with the thoughts. And if you can tune into the rapid flow, you can get a little sense of that, and then there's the next one and the next one and the next one, and that really helps, I think, to open this up. So Brigitte writes, I cannot clearly notice them every moment. Even tracing back a chain of thoughts, there was already a layer of other thoughts overlapping, and the connecting thread was tearing easily. Yes, I'm not saying that we can just flip into this other way of perceiving in which thoughts are just constantly on the move. It's helpful to get a sense of it, even if you then lose track of it. And sometimes, in some situations, it's easier to have that sense, and other times it's not. And of course, what typically tends to happen is that we get pulled into a thought. And maybe some of you had that experience just in these couple of minutes, that we get pulled in, and then it's very interesting because you say, well, where have we been pulled into? But it's like the phrase we have in English is we get lost in thought. And in fact, that happens a lot more often than people tend to think. And once we're in the thought, then we accept the claims to substance. And it's exactly the opposite of what this exercise is supposed to point to, you could say. Okay, well, let's move on a little bit. The question, and we're still just in the second paragraph on page 53. Tsarimshi asks the question, how is it that thoughts establish a world or confer substance? And he says, what you might say, well, that it's like if I serve you a meal, I have to have the food in my house to be able to prepare the meal. So if thoughts serve up substance, you might say, well, that means that thoughts must be substantial, or they couldn't serve up substance. And that's the question that Rinpoche raises here. But he suggests that that's not what allows thoughts to confer substance. Down at the bottom of page 53, he says we accept that power. And then he says, so, okay, I think maybe there's a connection that needs to be made here. He says we accept the power of thoughts to confer substance, even though it doesn't exactly make sense. So if we stay with the image of my offering you a meal, if I offered you a phantom meal, or instead of putting a bowl of soup in front of you, put the picture of a bowl of soup in front of you. If you accepted that that was in fact a bowl of soup, then everything would go along just fine, except you'd be hungry. But we don't have to get into that complication right now. And that is in fact, he says, what we do. Thoughts present experience, they label experience, they present it, and then they claim that that experience is substantial, and we accept that claim. You could say instead of testing for ourselves. And Rinpoche says here at the bottom of the page, we can trace this unthinking acceptance to our previous commitment to the communique. So the communique is, in fact, what thoughts communicate. It's the whole field gets communicated, right? The field communique. And we're committed to it. And because we're committed to it, we accept that the thought is contributing to the ongoing manifestation of that communique. We have no interest, no wish to question that. So it's kind of like a conspiracy, right? We're the ones who are the audience for the thought, but we have already agreed before we step into the theater or that we will accept whatever is presented to us. So it's like what I said before about the willing suspension of disbelief. That's what we do, and that's the basis for conferring substance. So in that sense, you'd say, well, there really isn't any basis for conferring substance. It's just that we're already primed, We've already agreed in advance that we're going to accept that. And that's why it's possible to change things. That's why it's possible to open up to more freedom. And why do we make that agreement? Well, because we want to have a home, right? Things have to fall into place. That's what we talked about last week. It's at the very bottom of page 52. You know, we get very concerned if things do not make sense. If there's a tear in the fabric of reality or a gap, we do everything we can to fill it in right away because we feel like we need to have that world to live in. Let's see, we're kind of running out of time. There's so many things to talk about. The thing that's kind of remarkable about this is that it's all made up. You know, it's because we accept it as true that we accept it as true. It's because we want to accept it as true, you could say, I guess, that we accept it as true. So, you might think about certain fictional accounts. I'm thinking of a movie that many of you may have seen, but it's quite an old movie now, called The Sting. And the whole idea in this movie, you can go look at it if you like, it's fun, is about, it's complicated, the background, I don't remember it, but people set up this whole reality just in order to get someone's money, basically. And they set up a world, and you know, it's a totally manufactured world. But people buy into it because they see that the people they're trying to trick think that they're going to be able to make a lot of money. And so they want to be able to believe that that's true. And it's something like that. So the alternative to that is learning to appreciate in the way that we just did in the exercise that we did. Learning to appreciate what Rinpoche calls on page 55, is it on 55? Yeah, it's a nice phrase. I like it. The transitional constructions of multidimensional appearance. So let's look at that sentence. Actually, Rinpoche here is very explicitly making the connection, which is the one that helps us see how this chapter relates to what we were doing last. In the last program, last class, he's saying thoughts are like space. You know, so at the bottom of page 54, he says, like the space that allows for physical objects, thought, apart from its content, presents itself as wholly lacking in substance, a blank availability. And he's just said before that, he said, thoughts make this claim of substance, and in doing that, they withdraw. That is to say, we never have any way of looking at the thought itself. We just get caught up in the substance of the thought. And that's just like space. Space allows certain objects, and it does so in such a way that space itself disappears. Space gets filled up completely. And the thought world is like that too, right? Thought is a blank availability. But in fact, in presenting itself in that way, it's confirming the substance of what it presents. So those things go together. And so then that leads us to this description that I just quoted from a moment ago, at the top of page 55, starting from the zero point of thought. And that's just like the zero point of space that we talked about last time, last quarter, last term. Starting from the zero point of thought, points take form as solid and zeroless space disappears into the dichotomy of substance and nothingness. Dichotomy meaning the twofold nature, right? The dualism. Gravity is activated. We talked about that. Order is imposed. We've talked about that. That's what thoughts do. They activate a certain gravity, they impose a certain order. Substance proliferates, and the transitional constructions of multidimensional appearance give way to a reality that has already been established. So our focus in that little exercise we did, and what I'm going to ask you to look at during the week too, is to look at those, to see if you can practice rediscovering appearance as transitional constructions that are multidimensional in their nature. So I think maybe that's where we can stop. I may start up, or maybe in the orientation for next week, I'll say a little something about a point that I wanted to bring up this week, which is this question that Rinpoche raises about, is the answer to this to go to direct experience instead? And I think maybe we'll talk about it next week because it's important. So this is on the first full paragraph on page 50. Yes? Yes.
When you write, would you also explain multidimensional when you write some more of what that phrase means?
I'll tell you what I'll give some sense of that. Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
So I'll write something about that, and then next week we will start with the first full paragraph on page 55. So that's adding a few paragraphs that we didn't get to this time. We'll deal with those next time. Okay, and I don't want to ignore a couple of things that Sudaba said. First, Brigitte said, and this still refers back to the exercise we did, that it's kind of a whirling quality. Well, yeah, this is transitional construction, so there's a movement. So I don't think anybody will get seasick. It's probably okay. But I don't mean to downplay that. Okay, so Sudaba's quoting, I think probably Herbert Günther. I'm not completely sure. So the recipient of this vision, like me, like us, we're deeply grateful to Tartan Tulku and to Jack for expounding further, for challenging me to think and to vision again differently from the blind way I used to see on the surface of this gravitational pull of the habitual thoughts and how this is so insubstantial. Well, that's a good summary of some of what we've been talking about. And in fact, I think it's very, I like the way you use gravitational pull here because it reminds us, you say, here we are on the surface of the Earth, on the surface of this physical planet, and it's gravity that holds us down. And there's nothing wrong with that. We don't want to go floating off into space. But it is, if we take it to be the only possible way of engaging the world, it's extremely limiting. It's like saying, we walk around on the surface of the Earth, but what if we could fly? That would be kind of an analogy. And let's see, there's an issue. Okay, I'm sorry. Sudi also says this projected and measurable familiarity confirms as known what is not known at all, what has been pronounced as real, has its source in an arising that remains mysterious. Yes, and it would be useful or interesting to talk about this idea of mystery. I think we need to be able to go beyond what's mysterious. That is, if we just leave it as mysterious, there's some value in that, but we want to, that's why we were looking so closely at how it gets set up and how thought is the one that's doing this constructing and presenting and pronouncing. Because if we just leave it mysterious, we tend to fall back into the usual way of doing things, and we say, oh, well, it's mysterious how this happens, and then we give up. We're trying to understand it. So that's what we'll do. We'll keep going on next week. I will write the orientation, and we'll start, as I said, on page 55, and I'll remind people of that in the orientation. Thank you, everybody.